This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Yesterday, the Chittenden Emergency Food Shelf sent out a press release urgently requesting groceries and turkeys. On Monday, the food shelf revealed it had served more people in a single day than ever before in its history, and its supplies were getting low right before Thanksgiving. That one call for help highlights the problem of food insecurity in Vermont. It's a year-round problem, not just at the holidays. But this time of year, when many of us are thinking about the joy of cooking for friends and neighbors, people who work to combat hunger try to remind us that not everyone has the luxury of fixing a huge Thanksgiving feast or baking cookies for their coworkers just for fun. One in eight Vermonters is not always sure where his or her food is going to come from. So today on the program, we're going to talk about hunger and what's being done to address its root causes. I'm joined now by Rob Meehan, director of the Chittenden Emergency Food Shelf, and by Marissa Parisi, executive director of Hunger Free Vermont. Nice to have you both on the show.
Thanks, Jane.
Thank you.
So, Rob, let me ask you first, just how many people did you serve on Monday?
So we served over 700 people on that day. And, you know, the people that we're serving are making tough choices whether to purchase food or medicine sometimes. Whether to purchase food or pay for housing or for transportation.
And 700, is that far out of the ordinary or just a little bit more than usual?
Yeah, per day, you know, on an average day, we see about 300 people.
So it's quite a bit above average.
Yeah, that represents households. So there's a lot of different people living in households that range from one to seven folks usually.
And when you put out that call to action asking people for turkeys and donations and money to support the food shelf, did you see that one day surge as a call to action or a sort of a good way to be able to remind people, look, this is a problem and we need some help? Or are you really concerned that you're low on food and may not have enough for people for Thanksgiving or other times?
Yeah, we're really concerned about the direction that we're heading. You know, with charitable food, we're really trying to supplement people's monthly incomes. We're really not trying to replace that. So if we're having a really hard time doing that, it just means the people we're trying to serve are really struggling.
Marissa Parisi, did it surprise you that the Chittenden Emergency Food Shelf had its highest day ever this week?
You know, no, I wouldn't say it surprised me. Knowing that I was coming on the show today as well, my colleague is in Brattleboro meeting with our Windham County Hunger Council, and two food pantries in Windham County also said they had one of their biggest days ever. And I think why it didn't necessarily surprise me is because at Hunger Free Vermont, we pay very close attention to the statistics about, you know, what's going on with hunger with some of the national measurements. But also, I know personally, it's getting colder. It happens every time in Vermont, right around the same time. When we're going into the holidays, it gets colder. People start filling up their fuel tanks, which is very expensive. And it really often competes with the family food budget. So that was the first thing that came to my mind was that here we go. We're going into, you know, those long, hard winters that are expensive in Vermont.
There must also, though, be a cultural piece here, too. I mean, this is a time of year in this country where we think about food and we think about food as part of our culture and how it ties us to one another. And if you are somebody who's facing food insecurity, that must, in addition to all of those pressures, Marissa, that you just mentioned, must also be a time when you think, boy, I want to be able to give my family that turkey and that feeling of fullness, both in terms of your stomach, but also in terms of love and social connection. So I imagine that's also a time when people are coming to the food shelves and saying, I'm hoping to get a little bit more so I can do this special thing for my family.
I think that's exactly right. And that's how I often in my work explain hunger is I use the word emptiness. And of course, there's the physical emptiness of hunger, but the mental, emotional, social, spiritual emptiness you feel when you can't participate or feel like you can't participate in how food brings us together and the love and connection food brings for one another. And that's another reason why I believe people were, you know, going to the Chittenden Emergency Food Shelf and looking to Rob and his great team for help because they want all that connection that comes along with having food at this time of year.
We're talking about hunger today, and we're going to look at some of the statistics about how many people in Vermont are facing food insecurity. But of course, behind the statistics are real people, families with small children, seniors on fixed incomes. If you have experience with hunger, with food insecurity, I'd love it if you would tell us what it feels like to be worried about how to afford food. Help us understand, for people who have not had that experience, what this feels like and what you think could be done to help the situation. How do you think the state should help? How do you think nonprofits should be involved? And what do you think would help treat the underlying causes that lead to food insecurity? Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Rob Meehan, is the specific pressure on food shelves higher at a certain time of the year? I mean, we talked about holidays, and Marissa mentioned that winter comes and there are a lot of other expenses. Is there particular pressure at this time of year?
Sure. I think there's pressure both with, you know, the holidays coming up and like you say, the desire for all of us to celebrate with our families and to be able to give and share. But there's also an opportunity for us during this time of the year as hunger relief advocates to raise awareness about, you know, the issues of hunger and poverty and really try to look for more impactful ways to, you know, to create solutions. And so we look at it, you know, as sort of a double-edged sword where we're seeing lines of people waiting for holiday baskets, and that can be a little heart-wrenching. But at the same time, we have opportunities to, you know, say that so much more is possible with hunger relief and that we really can work together with partnerships to try to create impactful change.
Marissa, I just mentioned that something like 1 in 8 Vermonters faces food insecurity, and the statistics say it's about 12.6% of the population is food insecure, and maybe you can define what that means.
Sure. I mean, from a purely statistical look at this, the U.S. Census contracts every year with the USDA to do what's called the food insecurity measure, the household and food insecurity measure. And every year we look at a 3-year average for our states. And while there's been really good work going on, what we're seeing is that the needle just is not moving. There's fantastic programs that our schools are running, that the Chittenden Emergency Food Shelf and others like it are running. But what we really see as an ongoing problem is that, first of all, our nutrition programs have eroded. Congress has eroded these programs over time. I was just telling Rob when I came in, I was looking at some historical information, and in the 60s and 70s, we saw chronic hunger and poverty across the country. So Congress made a $10 billion investment over a 10-year period. And by 1978, during that time, we were on track to ending hunger in this country. Then the Reagan administration happened and a dismantling of the programs. The Clinton administration happened, dismantling of the programs. And we've lost ground on the problem, partly because we've really eroded the safety net to the point where it's going only so far to make sure people can meet their basic needs.
So this is more a national problem than one that's specific to the state of Vermont.
You know, it's absolutely a national problem. But what is interesting in this year's state report that relates directly to Vermont is that rural communities are far worse off with food security and a measure called severe food insecurity. It's 17.1% in rural communities versus 13.5% in terms of the rate of food security when you compare the two. So in our rural communities, we're worse off. We're struggling more. And that's true in the very low food security measure. So Vermont has some very unique issues that make the problem actually worse here.
But that was a national statistic you mentioned, the 13% in urban communities face food insecurity and 17% in rural ones?
It's a comparison between the two types of communities.
Okay. And so is Vermont doing better than other states in the country?
Not really. I wish I could say we were. At times, we've had some of the worst severe food insecurity in the country. And when I say severe food insecurity, it means not just people are stretching food or not getting enough calories. They're getting no calories. They're going without food. So unfortunately, Vermont is exceptional in many ways in our country with food security. We're struggling so much, just like many other states are.
Marissa, is that because our safety net programs are not funded at a high enough rate, or is that because our cost of living is high and that puts an additional pressure on?
I would say it's both. What we see often is sometimes a program is designed for everyone in the country. So, for example, our child care nutrition programs are designed for any child care center in the country. Well, sometimes the scale of a New York City program makes that program much more successfully run in New York City than it would be in a small town in Vermont, where the New York City program might have 300 children, we might have 10. So a small reimbursement for meals for kids at a 10-child program, it's much easier to run with a bigger scale. So that often ends up being very tricky when we start accessing safety net programs in Vermont.
Robbie, and we're talking a little bit now about statistics, and I mentioned calling to our listeners saying if this is something that you can personalize for us, please do, because we're talking about real people. So maybe you could help us do that as well. Who are the people who you interact with who are facing these pressures that we've been talking about? What do they look like? What jobs do they have? You know, are they families? Are they older people? Just tell us, give us some faces that we can keep in our minds.
Sure. So throughout Chittenden County, we know there's 19,000 people that are living who are food insecure. We serve at the Chittenden Emergency Food Shelf about 11,000 of those with groceries. The people that we're serving are people who are seniors, people with disabilities, families with children. In fact, 22% of the folks we serve are children under the age of 18. So, and people who are homeless. So we're serving a large population of the most vulnerable people. And a lot of the folks we're serving are working, sometimes more than one job, oftentimes, and still having a hard time meeting the needs of housing and transportation. And, you know, of course, this ties to our economy and jobs, et cetera. What we're trying to do is include people in a process whereby people can help create food, can help participate, try to create ways for people to have a sense of giving. You know, and Thanksgiving is such a great time to talk about this because, like you said earlier, all of us are looking for that opportunity to have a sense of giving. We do that by way of inviting the community to give. But we also do that for our guests who can become more involved with what we do. So charitable food as an industry is really changing. The system that's existed for the last 25 years or so, it's not the most effective in the sense that it creates change. It's up to us as advocates to really look for avenues for change. And I'd love to tell you more ways.
Yeah, you mentioned that the guests that you serve, you're trying to get them more involved in the process. What does that look like?
Yeah, so some of those guests, I was saying a little bit earlier, you know, and Marissa mentioned stretching food. So one of the really interesting things about where I work is it's the most diverse location, and in that it's a refugee resettlement program, and that it's the largest population as far as counties go. And so we're able to do sort of case studies of the folks we serve and ask through surveys for feedback. And we learn that people skip meals so that their children can eat. They stretch food, as Marissa said, to try to make things last longer. So the added pressures during the holidays when you live in that environment, they're kind of unsurmountable. And if we can rally as a community, that can be really impactful in this moment. That can really help literally thousands of people.
But what does that mean, rally as a community? Because, you know, this is a time when we're thinking about that idea of food and thinking perhaps more about hunger and more about giving. And so perhaps you'll see donations rise, food donations and monetary donations. But what do you mean rally as a community?
If we can come together as families around our own, hopefully, dinner tables and have conversations about how we can help our neighbors. This is the spirit of Vermonters helping Vermonters. Unfortunately, this is also our largest fundraising time of the year, where we raise about 40% of our annual budget during the giving season. And this is a time where we also distribute the most amounts of food. So it's really the rallying of the community is through both education, through awareness, and through giving.
We heard from some people who are having those same thoughts that you're talking about, Rob. Patty says, I was very happy to hear that you're discussing the food insecurity challenges many families in our local communities face. I, too, have been concerned about this and was inspired to hold an event to raise funds to address food insecurity that many locally and globally face. The event, Giving Thanks and Giving Back, Community Rice and Bean Dinner, is being held at Sugarbush Gatehouse Lodge this Thursday, November 19th, from 6 to 10 p.m. And Teal says our 7th and 8th grade students have a theme of community every year that's spread throughout each academic class. This year, the focus is on how we can help our community. They'll be creating a project that can fill a need for themselves, the environment, or the community. And to get them started, we've worked with the Center for an Agricultural Economy, building 12 community garden boxes, fixing existing ones, and putting the pumpkin patch for Pies for People for next year. To keep the ball rolling, we're in the midst of a canned food drive, a coin drive for fresh produce for the Hardwick Food Pantry, about to bake 20 loaves of bread and dog biscuits, and doing a hygiene drive for Aware for people that need to leave their homes suddenly with nothing. And we think, we did a little sleuthing, we think we're getting some comments on this show from perhaps a class of students who's thinking about these issues. A lot of them came in at once, all from the same area, and we think it may be from a school. Regardless, there are people thinking about this. Elijah says, I wonder what hunger in Vermont will look like in 5 years. I feel that if we can educate people on proper eating habits, there will be substantially less hunger. Madeline says, maybe because it's basketball season, people could donate food to sell at the games and send the money and food that was collected at the games. And Bailey says, Vermont could make food more affordable and prices reasonable for people who are having trouble buying them because they don't have enough money. Well, we're going to talk more coming up about what can be done. What can be done statewide, governmentally, what can be done by nonprofits, and what can be done by individuals. So if you have questions or suggestions that you'd like to share, or if you'd like to tell us your own story, our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or send a note to vermontedition@vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Rob Meehan is director of the Chittenden Emergency Food Shelf, and Marissa Parisi is executive director of Hunger Free Vermont. Together, they're painting a picture of what hunger looks like in the state and why we're not seeing a decline in the number of Vermonters who struggle to afford food despite an improving economy. If you've faced hunger, you can tell us what it feels like to be worried about how to afford food and what you think would help. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post a thought on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Rick is calling in from South Burlington. Hi, Rick. Go right ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
I just wanted to make 2 points. The first is, I think it's perfectly reasonable that you should have more and more people needing services, because it pretty directly relates to policy decisions that either have been made or in some cases have not been made to deal with things like minimum wages federally and locally in the states. And the other, and so as more and more people have to work longer and longer hours at lower and lower salaries in relation to the cost of living, it's gotten much worse over the last few decades. But the second point is that it doesn't have to be that way. I was recently in Australia, where their federal minimum wage at the moment is $17.30 Australian. It's about 14 U.S. And it all goes back to a very famous case where a judge in a worker versus a federal situation in the early 1900s decreed that if somebody is going to work a full work week, it wasn't defined, but 40 hours, he or she ought to, as a minimum, be able to earn enough to at least live in a very frugal manner.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. And in fact, that's become a big question in some of the early presidential debates, particularly among the Democrats, although also within the Republican Party. We're seeing some daylight between the candidates and among the candidates on what a livable wage might look like in a federal minimum wage. Marissa Parisi, is that something that you're advocating for here in Vermont, what a livable wage might be?
Well, it is. And I know it's also something that Rob and our friends at all the food pantries across the state feel. It's about wages. It's about a lot of things, though. I'm not personally an economist, but there's a whole host of things that we need to do to address income inequality and make it possible for you to work, meet your basic needs, and also take care of your family. So I think Rick, who called in, is absolutely right that we can do this at a policy level. You know, what I shared at the top of the program about that, we've done this once already. We know how to do it, how to help people, you know, get out of poverty and get out, you know, not be hungry.
Again, from our perhaps young listeners who've written in, Caleb says, I think that if we build a community garden in every town, we could lower the amount of hungry households in Vermont. Each town can grow food for the hungry people living there. And Owen says solving other big problems in Vermont, like a lack of public transportation a lack of affordable housing, low wages, high unemployment, and a decrease in the number of local affordable grocery stores will help our hunger problem. I also want to mention a note that we got from John Sales, who's CEO of the Vermont Food Bank, who says, you know, I could spout a lot of statistics, but I'd rather share some actual quotes for neighbors who visited food shelves around the state and left a message on a paper plate. And he has some of them for us. He says, this is from a visitor to the Chittenden Emergency Food Shelf, who writes, I'm 18 years old and I got kicked out of my parents' house with no job, no license, and nothing to survive on but hope for help. If the food shelf wasn't here, I don't think I'd make it 48 hours into my long journey of hoping for a better tomorrow. God bless. From the Bible Basket Food Shelf in Bennington, a note that says, I'm 90 years old, on limited income. Sometimes I run out of food. I just call the food shelf and they will bring it to me. I cannot get out on my own. And from the Montgomery Food Shelf, my husband is sick with cancer and unable to work. What little money we have coming in is stretched to the limit. John Sale says, hunger is a complex challenge, but not insurmountable. Our neighbors want to be their best selves. Enough food and a safe place to live are a necessary starting place. Everyone has a responsibility to pitch in, donate, volunteer, or advocate. Rob, I would love you to build on what we got there from John Sales.
Yeah, I love that. The hearing from Owen as well, and from Rick, I think those are wonderful sentiments. I agree that we need more government policy involvement in order to make more enormous change. But for the folks that we're serving each day, to cross that threshold into a food pantry and ask for help is not an easy thing. We have people that I have one story of a woman who sat in her car. A really hard decision to walk in and ask for help. And we do our best, and I know others do too, to try to greet people with as much dignity and respect as we can. And we're also trying to create opportunities for people to get involved through our culinary job training, which is a partnership with the food bank, as well as through our Good Food Truck program, where we bring food out into communities for folks who maybe don't want to cross that threshold and ask for help, or for people who have transportation issues and mobility impairments for a number of reasons. So I love hearing the conversation about ways we can work together to help people.
Marissa, why is it so difficult sometimes to cross that threshold and ask for help?
Yeah, well, I think we also talked at the, you know, we've been talking about this, about the incredible volumes we're seeing, too, of people that have to ask for help. So, you know, from Hunger Free Vermont's perspective, we really see that so much of the responsibility of hunger is now getting moved to these great community organizations like Rob's organization. But to us, it's just really unacceptable. And we got a note a couple of years ago from somebody who had said for the first time ever, they felt like they needed help. They really were struggling with the idea that they might see somebody they know at their local food shelf. So they did everything they could. They put on their dark hat and their dark glasses and got there to get out of the car and go get a turkey for the first time ever. And the media was there doing a great big turkey drive. And then the person felt worried that they were going to be on the news and got back in their car and left. And I know, you know, organizations across the state do such a good job at our food pantries. Rob and his team does such an awesome job. But the bottom line is, where all these volumes should be of concern to us, that we're relying on our community to this extent to provide food for 1 in 8 Vermonters. Now, that's an epidemic that we know the stats aren't changing. So it's concerning to me that the responsibility is getting so shifted to the community when really we need policy change to make sure that people not only have an adequate safety net, but they have the resources to like take care of themselves and make their own choices at Thanksgiving and go to the store with dignity just like everybody else.
I want to drill down a little deeper into what it is that both of you are hoping to have happen, both at the policy level, specific policy requests that you have, Marissa Parisi, for Montpelier, and also, Rob, what you're hoping for community partners to do and for individuals. But let me first go to a couple of calls that we have, and if you'd like to share your thoughts, our number is 1-800-639-2211, 1-800-639-2211. Susie's calling in from Rutland. Hi, Susie, your thoughts today.
Hi. I just wanted to share that I'm on an extremely low income on disability. I can't work. And I have less than $200 a month on food stamps. But by utilizing the Crop Cash program, where you can go to the farmer's market and get tokens with your food stamps and they'll match up to $10 with crop cash, I'm able to eat about 80% organic. I stagger what I buy so that I can buy maybe a pound of grass-fed beef hamburger once a week and pad it out with beans that I get at the local food co-op so they're not canned. But I'm really trying to get my health back and reduce medications. So eating healthy is really, really important. And if more people knew about this program, then maybe they'd be able to eat more healthy. I also make my own Greek yogurt in the slow cooker. I learn a lot from YouTube videos. And you can do it.
Susie, thanks for your call. I appreciate that. And it's nice to hear what you do to make your dollars stretch further. Ramian, you just mentioned a partnership that you have with the food bank. And this is something that we've heard over the years, that part of one of the issues among many is helping people understand how to cook their own food, how to make their food stretch further, how to cook things that are nutritious on a budget. So that's clearly a piece of what Susie's talking about as well, that it can be difficult to eat healthily when you have a limited income, but there are ways that you're helping people understand how to do that better.
Sure. Nutrition and cooking classes, which I know we partnered with Hunger Free to put on, as well as our culinary job training program. What we're trying to do is share with one another ways in which to stretch food dollars and learn how to try to eat healthy and move our bodies in ways that we can in order to live the most healthy life possible. It's really difficult if you're stretched so thin economically that there's very little in your cupboards to cook with. And so I've had a lot of folks with diverse backgrounds who've come from maybe other countries where eating is pretty healthy and have told me point blank, I don't really need your advice on how to cook, but what I really need is money. And again, unfortunately, that's what we're talking about. People that are making really tough choices, whether to have healthcare or food, it's based solely on money. And that's the heart of the matter for us and what we really want to try to overcome. So including people in that process, absolutely. And Susie, what a wonderful presentation on what she's doing around food and learning and YouTube and Express. That's wonderful.
So if what you're looking for and what your guests and clients are looking for is more money to be able to have that food that they need, what is your call to action?
Well, Marissa said it really well at the beginning. There was a time in this nation where we had enough money through our federal government. In this case, let's just focus on food stamps, now called SNAP. In our state, that's called Three Squares. If we had enough money in our Three Squares budget, we could end hunger in this country.
That's a pretty solid plan. But you can't make that happen.
And so since I can't make that happen, what I can do with those that are around me, as Rick mentioned in his call, he didn't see a horizon that had a fully funded hunger budget. And so since we don't, the idea is to partner with others to focus on ways to get federal help, workforce development, for example, and expanding those services through partnerships. And we're learning a lot in Vermont of how to work better together as agencies in order to share our strengths.
So for people who say, well, okay, I've got $10 or I've got a turkey that I can donate to the food shelf, it's probably not an either or, but are you saying that's great, but I also want your advocacy? I mean, are you asking people to step up and advocate as well politically?
Absolutely, but I must say that it's imperative that people donate because Uncle Sam is not. So we really need, especially now, donations are down. We're seeing less food through food drives. We're seeing less monetary donations. And in just today, we're seeing less turkey donations for our turkey roundup. So, I think the conversation around a dinner table and around an office can be about policy and what can we do to make change. And a call to Marissa is not a bad idea in that case. And also, how do we help people today with making sure they can have the best Thanksgiving possible?
And Marissa, what about for you? I mean, you advocate at the state level. You also advocate at the national level. Every time I see you, you've just been down to Washington, D.C. to talk to national leaders about what needs to be done. So what specific policies are you looking at that you think should be put in place to basically treat the underlying issues that are leading to food insecurity?
Well, several things, of course. Like you said, I was just down in D.C. a couple of weeks ago doing quite a bit of advocacy. And I guess I, you know, you said, Jane, to Rob that, you know, OK, you can't increase food stamps yourself. So how are you going to do that? And I just don't agree. I think what we're missing in this country is the political will to say it is absolutely unacceptable to cut programs that keep our citizens healthy, fed, housed, warm. And that's where we focus as policy advocates. So right now, when I was in Washington, D.C., I was focusing on the child nutrition reauthorization. Because at Hunger Free Vermont, what we want is every family to have food every single day, not just at the holidays, and use, like Susie said, food as medicine. So one of the things we focused on in the last 2 years has been our universal school meal outreach, where there is, you know, thanks to the advocacy of many anti-hunger groups across the country, we can now help schools in our highest poverty areas serve free school meals, breakfast and lunch to all children who attend the school regardless of income. Right now, we've helped 53 schools get on that program with over 11,000 kids in Vermont getting free meals every day regardless of their family's income. So it's things like that we had the power in that to work with our communities and work with our friends as advocates to make policy change that now has widespread impact.
We actually did a story with a principal on that very program, and we'll put a link to that on our Facebook page, the Vermont Edition Facebook page, for people who want to hear that, because the principal talks specifically about what this has meant for his students in terms of their attention spans and their behavior and why for some kids it's made a difference to have this for every person in the school rather than just for the kids who are on limited incomes. Let's go to Graydon, who's calling in from Hardwick. Hi, Graydon. Go ahead.
Hi.
Go ahead, Graydon.
How can we raise awareness all year long and not just for the holidays?
Graydon, good question. Robmian, how do we raise awareness all year long and not just at this time of year when people are thinking about this and when organizations like yours make it a point to raise awareness? How do we do it in springtime and summertime?
Well, across the country, organizations like ours ask that question, and we try to rally our communities around events and through different ways to organize food as the conversation starter. But it's teachers and it's schools and it's people that aren't in the hunger relief communities that really are the ones that move this issue forward. And our job as advocates is to try to provide data and information and real stories. So if anyone's interested beyond the holidays and getting involved, that's what I would recommend, is looking at ways to start a conversation around food.
Are there specific food products that are particularly helpful? Just for people who are thinking very concretely right now, and you're going to go and get some supplies, what should people be getting?
For any local food pantries, would really welcome staple items that you'd have in your household that are protein items, whether that's tuna fish or peanut butter, or whether that's cereals or pastas and things like that. But around the holidays, we're asking for fixings for a really great Thanksgiving feast.
All right. We'll put links up at vpr.net for people who want to know more or want to know where to give. Rob Meehan is director of the Chittenden Emergency Food Shelf, and Marissa Parisi is executive director of Hunger Free Vermont. Thanks to both of you for being here.
Thank you, Jane.
Thank you so much, Jane.
We've just been talking about food insecurity, and I want to let you know that tomorrow we're going to cast the net a little bit wider to look at poverty in Vermont, which is, of course, one of the underlying issues that we've been talking about today. We're going to look at a new report that discusses how the state is faring and what investments and policy initiatives should be undertaken to reduce poverty. But coming up next on today's show, can you preserve the rainforest by selectively harvesting its trees? We'll talk with two Vermont men who say working with local people in Guatemala to create a working landscape is essential for the conservation of the landscape there. You're listening to Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. A partnership between a Vermont wood products company and the Rainforest Alliance aims to help preserve biodiversity and improve the local economy in the Petén region of Guatemala. Parker Nichols owns Vermont Wildwood. Ben Hodgden is the director of forestry for the Rainforest Alliance. That's based in New York City, but has an office in Richmond, Vermont, where Ben works. Ben Hodgson says creating a working landscape and working with local residents is essential for conserving the forest, and he explained to us how Rainforest Alliance works within that model.
our mission is to conserve biodiversity and ensure sustainable livelihoods by transforming land use practices, business practices, and consumer behavior. In the field, we're working across three sectors, agriculture, tourism, and forestry, really on three fronts. First is certification, so assurance against a range of international standards. Second is working with a range of companies from the largest international players, such as International Paper, Chiquita Banana, Unilever, to companies like guitar makers all along the supply chain, and then obviously entrepreneurs. So our support to them is focused on building up community capacity to run locally owned enterprises based on sustainable forest harvesting and getting them access to premium markets.
So where does Parker Nichols come in on that?
Responsible buyers like Parker are fundamental to the model because ultimately what we're promoting are working landscapes, really as a counterpoint to what's been the dominant mode of conservation strategy in the tropics over the last few decades, which has been strict protection. Our approach emphasizes working landscapes, recognizing that strict protection has not functioned well to control deforestation or to provide opportunities for economic development for marginalized groups. But this model really only functions when we have responsible buyers like Parker and on up the line to larger companies that are committed to sourcing from sustainably managed forests.
Parker, your business is mostly working with butternut, which is a salvage wood here, diseased butternuts. So how did you get connected to this market in Guatemala to be one of those buyers that Ben is talking about?
I had really wanted to get involved and have kind of believed in this business model of the triple bottom line of there's financial success, but there's also a social and environmental, and was trying to find a way to give back and see if there was something I could do to make a difference.
And how does your experience working with this very different kind of wood in Vermont play into how you can help or advise in Guatemala?
Well, I knew that I was in when Ben said, well, you know, what? Tell me how you could, you know, make a difference down here and how what could your skills do? I said, well, I want to look at the trash pile down there. He's like, all right, that's it, we're going. Because that, to me, that's where there's a lot of beauty. There's a Japanese term called wabi-sabi, and that term means honoring the inner inherent beauty in natural products. And to me, oftentimes, that's not allowed to happen in a construction project. Anything that has a knot or an off color is cut out or put in the closet. And to me, that's where some of the most beautiful parts of the tree are. And so when we got down there, that's what I wanted to do. I could see that there was just so many of the buyers just wanted the clear mahogany. That's the dominant species. And it's been pretty clear from conversations with Ben that some of the bigger national brands that have been interested in this wood have kind of balked at the concept. And so I'm hopeful that I can go down. And I'm actually working with a couple of three different Vermont companies who are very interested in purchasing this wood. And we actually are hoping to put together a trip to go down this winter to look at how we can incorporate some of these lesser known species.
Like what? What are some of the species?
The one in particular is called Santa Maria. And it has many of the working properties and visual properties of mahogany. But a lot of these woods, even here in the Northeast, for lack of a better term, it's a beauty contest. It's or a popularity contest. The people love cherry. They love maple. So it's an educational process of letting people know there are a lot of other great things out there, but it's changing the way they get to look at them.
Ben, why is that a helpful part of the model if mahogany is a big seller and could be a sustainable timber industry product all on its own?
In the Petén, in this part of Guatemala where we've been supporting communities to manage forests for 15 years, mahogany has long been virtually the sole focus of harvesting along with the Spanish cedar. And concerns around the sustainability of harvesting are probably less in the Petén than in other parts of the tropics. That being said, it's important what Parker's mentioning, the extent of the ability for the communities to diversify their production out to a whole range of different species that are in the woods, because in neighboring countries such as Mexico, Honduras, Nicaragua, Peru, where there is a sole focus on mahogany, there's clear evidence of over-harvesting, which obviously puts the long-term sustainability of forest management at risk. And so the ability to harvest, to have a market for a range of lesser-known species, not only creates greater economic opportunity because there's simply a bigger number of species that can be sold on the market, but in the case of mahogany, we know that it requires pretty large openings in the canopy for regeneration. And if there's no economic incentive to be doing any harvesting of nearby trees, it can be difficult through single tree selection of mahogany to secure adequate regeneration over the long term.
Parker, for you, this is potentially a business plan or part of your business, because you could act as somebody who's actually purchasing that timber from Guatemala.
There is a chance that I may get to be able to add this to my repertoire, if you will. But for me, that's secondary. And I, if that works, that's great. But it is more important for me to help to spread the word about changing people's public perception about cutting in the rainforest, because there was a successful campaign of, you know, stay out of the rainforest, you know, don't cut the rainforest. And so this concept of going in and treating this part, different parts of the world as a working landscape is a really a new concept, but I think it's one that's really important. You know, that's one of the things that make people who live in Vermont so proud is of our working landscape and our farms and forests. And I think it's time to change public perception to allow people to understand, if done properly, that this is a really good thing and it's probably the best model to save our rainforests. And I'm really enjoying getting a chance to look at these woods and run them through my joiner and my planer and put oil on them and see what they look like, because it's all new and it's really exciting.
Ben, pick up where Parker was talking about the idea of a working landscape and respecting that that's a model that works for us and could work for other places, rather than saying just conserve the rainforest as is, as untouched, untrammeled wilderness. Because here in Vermont, we certainly do have the working landscape, but we also have preserved and conserved spaces that are not for timber or agriculture. So what do you think about how that model works and where it breaks down?
The example that we've been talking about and the site that we brought Parker to visit, which is the Mine Biosphere Reserve in Guatemala, is really a good example. In a lot of ways, it sort of parallels the Adirondack Park, where it's really a mosaic of land uses. As you said, Jane, it's not simply about, you know, either working forests or strictly protected areas. Most of the forest areas that we're working in the tropics, if they're classified as active forest management units, typically up to half or even sometimes a majority of the forest management unit is under some kind of conservation status for different reasons. What I mean when I talk about the failure of strict protection and large strict protected areas throughout the tropics over the last few decades is more one where communities are excluded and where use of the forest resource is excluded wholesale. And what we've learned and what we've seen in places like the Maya Biosphere Reserve, where you have strict protection next to areas that are working forest in concessions, controlled by communities, producing economic opportunity, the deforestation rates are much, much lower, close to zero in the active forestry concessions than in nearby strict protection reserves, where there really isn't the wherewithal or the rights to protect lands from conversion. It's something that we're seeing take hold increasingly in places like the Congo Basin and in Southeast Asia, together with moves to decentralize forest management and devolve increasing authority into community hands.
Parker, I can tell when you talk that this is a project that you're excited about, and it sounds like you've been down to the region once and you're hoping to go back now?
Yeah, just yesterday I was with a Vermont customer who was really excited about this, because it really is. You're right, I am excited. And it's something that's really easy to get excited about, because it's such a great thing to actually be able to put something into practice that so often the only thing you can do is say, you know, save the rainforest or save the elephants, but to actually be able to put what you do every day into practice and realize that you actually might be able to do something is a really exciting proposition for me. And yeah, I'm planning to go down this winter with at least one of the customers, if not a couple of them, because they want to see it. They want to understand, you know, it's sort of the, you know, like, who's your farmer? My wife is a commercial organic vegetable farmer, retired. You know, these bumper stickers of who's your farmer? And it's like, who's your logger, you know? And who are these people who are doing it? And getting to know them and put a face on the people who are actually living down there and understanding that these are decent people trying to do the right thing. And so if we can go down and lend a hand and in a new world sort of way and say, hey, this is your place. You guys are doing a great job. What do you have for us? You know, what can we work together on to try to make your life better and offer a product that people can feel really good about here?
That was Parker Nichols of Vermont Wildwood, and we were also talking with Ben Hodgdon, Director of Forestry for the Rainforest Alliance. Now, earlier on the show, we were talking about hunger. A new report on poverty was delivered to Governor Shumlin last week. It prescribes redirecting funds to reduce homelessness, increasing the state's support of fuel assistance programs, and providing investments in micro-businesses. Tomorrow on the program, we'll look at poverty in Vermont and how it can be reduced, and I'd love to have your questions or comments or suggestions about poverty. Our email address is vermontedition@vpr.net, and you can listen live tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri and Sam Gale Rosen, with production assistance from Hannah Kearns. Liam Connors directed the show, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.